Welcome to Current and Future Role of PARP Inhibitors in the Management of Ovarian Cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Ursula Matulonis from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and to begin, she presented a 55-year-old woman from her practice with recurrent ovarian cancer.
She's 55 years old, was diagnosed with advanced ovarian cancer, and went to surgery first, underwent an optimal cytoreductive surgery, and at that point of the time of surgery, had an intraperitoneal catheter placed, but developed postoperative hydronephrosis, bilateral hydronephrosis. So, you know, originally going to give her intraperitoneal cisplatin, but then switch to carboplatin and paclitaxel.
So just to clarify, the creatinine that went up and the ureteral was from the ureteral obstruction from tumor?
It was ureteral obstruction from post-surgical changes.
Post-surgical changes. Interesting.
Correct.
Huh. So that made it more complicated to give intraperitoneal therapy.
Because of the creatinine going up. That's correct. Yep.
Right.
So we switched her to carbotax. The original plan was IP-CIS, then changed those plans, carboplatin IV and paclitaxel IV, received 6 cycles of chemotherapy, went into remission, and was in remission for a bit, I think at least a year plus, and then developed symptoms of some colonic bleeding and was found to have a serosal implant along the large intestine, along the colon, that was actually drilling into the colon, causing bleeding. She had that resected and then underwent another round of platinum.
And I see that this involvement in the colon was from the ovarian cancer.
Correct. Exactly. That's right. And so she received more platinum-based chemotherapy, again went into remission, and then I think that's when we considered her for a PARP inhibitor. So she was part of our, right at the beginning, the randomized trial of olaparib versus olaparib plus cediranib. Our group had just completed the phase 1 of olaparib cediranib, got the phase 2 dosing, the recommended phase 2 dosing, and then put that into the randomized phase 2 for patients with platinum-sensitive recurrent ovarian cancer, so not as maintenance therapy, but as primary therapy. And she was randomized to the single-agent olaparib arm. That was just when olaparib was showing activity in recurrent ovarian cancer, specifically BRCA positive. And our group had also just completed a single-agent cediranib trial for patients with platinum-resistant, predominantly in recurrent ovarian cancer, showing activity very comparable to bevacizumab. So we thought, well, gee whiz, why don't we just put both of these together and see what happens? And it's now that we saw this, I think, pretty impressive phase 2 data showing that the progression-free survival was better for the combination compared to olaparib alone, specifically in patients with BRCA wild type, so BRCA negative patients or unknown. So now we're actually going back to the patient-derived xenograft models and trying to understand why this combination is potent.
So you mentioned that the similarity, I guess, certainly mechanistically and also maybe in your mind therapeutically, of an agent like cediranib, a TKI with bevacizumab. What do we know about cediranib? And I mean, is it likely or possible it'll become approved?
So cediranib is an oral VEGF receptor 1, 2, and 3 inhibitor. It was studied in ICON 6 in combination with carboplatin-based chemotherapy for patients with platinum-sensitive recurrent disease. And it was a trial that was recently just published in Lancet Oncology, but it's a study that went through some ups and downs. It was terminated early for a variety of reasons, but it was terminated early. But the end result was that there was a progression-free survival benefit for the addition of cediranib to platinum-based chemotherapy. And it was actually submitted to the EMA, but just recently withdrew it. So I think from a strategy of adding cediranib to platinum-based chemotherapy for platinum-sensitive recurrent disease, that's not going to happen. I think that what may happen, and we'll see, there are 2 phase 3 studies open, GY004, GY005, which are in either platinum-sensitive recurrent cancer, ovarian cancer, GY004, and GY005 is for patients with platinum-resistant cancer. And it's different than our study, but it is looking at the combination of olaparib-cediranib versus standard of care chemotherapy. So in patients with platinum-sensitive disease, it's in comparison to carboplatin doublet versus olaparib alone versus the combination. And then in the platinum-resistant setting, there's really a pick the winner before it launches into phase three, but it's the combination versus olaparib versus cediranib versus the doctor-patient choice of single-agent chemotherapy. So pegylated liposomal doxorubicin, weekly paclitaxel, topotecan, etc. So those are now launched, and I'd say they're about a third of the way accrued.
So if I heard you correctly, the first trial for platinum-sensitive did not have a cediranib alone arm?
That's correct.
But the platinum-resistant does?
In the pick-the-winner part of it, yes.
Because, I don't know, as an outsider, when I look at, you know, bevacizumab, one of the things that, I don't know, it just strikes me hearing, talking to people like you, is the monotherapy usage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the patient with a lot of ascites, the patient whereas monotherapy, you actually get a clinical benefit that you can see in front of you, as opposed to adding it to chemotherapy where it becomes a statistical thing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that cediranib would have that kind of single agent activity? Have you seen any patients, you know, again, the sort of ascites kind of a model? And is it possible that it could help people that are resistant to bevacizumab?
So good questions. In the trial that our group did, the phase two, and that was a CTEP, CTEP gave us the drug, and that's been published in the JCO now a number of years ago. There are all sorts of patients on that trial. They had to have good performance status. So typically somebody who had lots of disease burden, lots of ascites, may or may not have gone on that trial. So I can't with sort of assurance say that a single agent, either Bev or single agent oral cediranib is going to have that level of activity to take a patient with platinum resistant cancer who's got tumor burden and who's got lots of ascites is going to render that patient symptom free. I think the data is just not there to support that, at least for cediranib. And I think with bevacizumab, the AURELIA data really shows that the winner of those three arms in AURELIA is adding to weekly paclitaxel with bevacizumab.
So this lady now has had, it looks like, several lines of chemotherapy. She's had surgery. She's got progressive disease. What was her clinical condition when she went on this trial?
She was actually in very good shape. She had a great performance status. It was zero. And, you know, because of the CA125 biomarker being very sensitive and specific for picking up recurrence, it had been slowly rising. And the minute it had started to go up, had done a CAT scan, saw a parasplenic or perisplenic metastasis, probably, then followed it up in a few weeks later and documented that there was actually growth of this splenic, perisplenic metastasis.
So that was the only lesion that was imaged?
Yeah, that was her predominant RECIST image, that's right. She had some low-level peritoneal disease, but certainly not enough to give her significant ascites.
So she, as you said, got randomized to olaparib alone. What happened?
So she went on the dose that is now FDA approved, and that's 400 milligrams twice daily of using the capsule form. And she has done well. You know, she's been in remission now for, she started the trial, I believe, in 2011.
Wow.
But she did have some anemia. She presented with increasing fatigue and kind of watched that over a period of a few months. She got to actually grade 3 anemia and then made that decision that she was tired. It was that level of anemia was impacting her life negatively and then brought her from 400 twice daily down to 200 twice daily, which we know from study 12, Stan Kay's trial that looked at 400 twice daily, 200 twice daily versus pegylated liposomal doxorubicin, that those two doses of olaparib are pretty comparable. You may miss a few patients in the lower dose, but that's certainly an acceptable dose to drop down to.
And what happened to the lesion, the parasplenic lesion?
It's now gone. I mean, her scans have a complete response.
And what about her CA125?
It's been five, six. It's been totally low and stable.
Did you consider, and do you sometimes in patients who are responding who become anemic from olaparib, transfusion?
I think she did get a transfusion when she had that grade 3 symptomatic anemia. And that was really that episode of transfusion. And then the patient herself really feeling fatigued. She's a skier. She's very active. She works full time. So that level of anemia was definitely impacting her quality of life negatively. And she's done subsequently very well. I mean, that was a very early dose reduction, I think 4 to 5 months into the original dosing of olaparib. So she's been really doing quite well since then.
Any GI side effects?
No, she has not, surprisingly. You know, I know that in women who take olaparib, or any PARP inhibitor for that matter, one of the class effects has been gastrointestinal toxicities, some nausea, dyspepsia, anorexia, occasional vomiting, and some lower GI effects, such as diarrhea, but it's mostly upper GI effects. But remarkably, she has not had any of those.
Do you typically start preemptively with anti-nausea medications, et cetera, when you start olaparib, or you wait and see what happens?
I will counsel patients that that is a possible side effect. You know, certainly focusing on GI toxicities and then heme toxicities. But most of the time, they will have a prescription for antiemetics at home. And if they don't, I can write for them. But I would not, I don't preemptively give them anti-nausea medicines to take, no.
So she's right now having no tolerability issues with the treatment?
She's having no tolerability issues with the treatment. That's correct.
In these patients, such as this one, who are identified, I assume she has no family history of breast or ovarian cancer, or does she?
She does have a family history.
What kind of family history?
So her mother had breast cancer in her 60s.
I see. And was the mother tested for BRCA?
Yes, she has been tested. So the whole family now, that kind of cascade testing has happened where the patient herself has sons, but certainly her siblings understand that there's now this BRCA mutation in the family.
Does her mom have BRCA?
She does have BRCA, yes.
Huh. And I'm kind of curious because, you know, now obviously BRCA testing is a therapeutic issue.
Correct.
But of course, it's also a genetic issue. Are there situations where, I don't know, people don't want to tell their families or the families don't want to know? You see what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
You're doing it for therapeutic reasons, but you might be thinking differently in terms of the family. I'm curious what you kind of run into.
Oh, absolutely. I've seen women in my practice recently where there's been a known mutation in the family, but that information has not been disseminated to all family members. And hence, the woman who doesn't know that her family has this potential risk, or she has this potential risk, ends up developing an advanced ovarian cancer where it could have been preventable by identifying her as somebody who could potentially have a BRCA mutation, undergo testing, and then undergo risk-reducing surgery.
So another issue is the question of BRCA testing in general in patients with ovarian cancer. So agree or disagree, the diagnosis of ovarian cancer in and of itself, regardless of who it is, what the stage is, means the patient should have BRCA testing.
100% agree.
So would it surprise you that as recently as 2 weeks ago, I continue to see when we survey mainly medical oncologists and gynecologic oncologists, actually now that I think about it, because we asked this at SGO last year, there's always like 25% of people who aren't doing it.
Yeah. It is amazing to me because this is the one way that we can help prevent ovarian cancer. We don't have screening mechanisms at all, but we do have a way of identifying high-risk women. And it's exactly here. You've got the patient who's got the unfortunate diagnosis. Well, let's make some good from this and disseminate that information to the rest of the family that they should undergo testing.
Anyhow, just a commentary of maybe a need for some education. And certainly this case, imagine what would have happened to this lady if she were BRCA negative or she had not gotten a PARP inhibitor.
Right, exactly.
You know, she's running out of options. Now she's in a complete remission because we knew she was BRCA positive. Oh, I think we're going to get to the fact that maybe this story is going to be a lot more complicated than that. So I wanted to use this case because when I saw that she had this response, and obviously not everybody responds like this, but it's a real statement about, I think, the biology of ovarian cancer. So I wanted to use this as a takeoff for a general discussion. I'm going to ask you in a minute to review what we know about olaparib.
Yep.
And then we'll go through the other ones that are coming out now. But I wonder if you could just take a step back and talk a little bit about the way you currently visualize the biology of ovarian cancer, the biology of PARPness, so to speak, and maybe how you explain it to your fellows at a basic level of, you know, why it is that some of these patients do so well like this lady did on PARP inhibitors.
Yeah, so the PARP field has been a remarkable field starting in around 2006, 2007, and it's really blossomed into this important class of drugs, not only for ovarian cancer, but for other types of cancers as well, namely prostate cancer. I mean, I think that whole story is just fascinating and really represents a new class of agents for difficult-to-treat prostate cancer. So how I envision is there was some fumbling in terms of initial trial design with olaparib, different kind of approval strategies taken, and study 19 being the use of olaparib in maintenance therapy, try to distill a patient population that would be most sensitive or have a cancer most sensitive to a PARP inhibitor. And that is high-grade tumors, high-grade serous cancer, high-grade endometrioid cancers that are responding to platinum, have been in response to platinum previously, and are currently in response to platinum. So really distilling a specific patient population. And I think when you think more broadly of ovarian cancer, what has been, I think, a great, which is just, I think, super exciting moving forward, is that you can see the pathology. So the pathologist gives you a diagnosis, and that pathology then gives you the sense of the genomics of the cancer. So you think about high-grade serous carcinoma, low-grade serous carcinoma, endometrioid, high-grade, low-grade, clear cell cancer, mucinous tumors. They all have their different underlying genomic underpinnings. Where mucinous cancers have more KRAS mutations, they are more chemotherapy insensitive, all the way to high-grade serous cancers, high-grade endometrioid cancers, which probably half of them have this underlying homologous recombination deficiency kind of genomic picture. About 20 to 25% of the whole group will be underlying BRCA, so either germline BRCA positive tumor or somatic BRCA positive. And then I think where it's a little more murky is how to define that other portion of that 50% who are truly homologous recombination deficiency positive. And you've already alluded to some of those tests that are being done. I think we're in the very, very early understanding of how to predict for the sensitivity to a PARP inhibitor or to elicit the patient or call out the patient and her cancer that's going to be sensitive to PARP inhibitor. And then adding something potentially to a PARP inhibitor to make that HR, maybe it's deficient, but making it even more deficient, or taking an HR proficient, meaning it's got great DNA repair mechanisms going on, but making that HR deficient through combination therapy.
So for those of us who graduated from medical school more than 3 years ago, can you talk a little bit more about the biology of HR? Like, what really is it?
Yeah, well, it's a hugely complicated field, and I am very fortunate to have folks like Alan DeAndrea, who I work with at Dana-Farber, who are truly DNA repair experts. And yeah, I mean, I think there are multiple ways that DNA repairs itself after breaks occur. Very simplistically, PARP inhibitors have multiple ways that they work. One is through base excision repair, which helps repair single-strand breaks. If you inhibit PARP, and thus base excision repair, those defects then get shunted into double-strand defects, which then rely on a very finely tuned, very elegant way of repairing DNA through homologous recombination, predominantly repairing the very critical double-strand break. So if a cell can't fix a double-strand break, it essentially dies. So if there's something wrong with homologous recombination, such as any one of the number of proteins, but predominantly BRCA1 and 2, then that DNA does not get repaired. So if you either have a patient who's got a mutation within BRCA1 or 2 where that protein is either absent or non-functioning or not functioning 100%, then the cell doesn't repair that double-stranded break. But PARP inhibitors work other ways as well, and mostly through shunting the DNA breaks through other repair mechanisms that are not as fine-tuned and are more error-prone, like things like non-homologous end joining, which are just clunkier and error-prone and may not fix the problem. So PARP inhibitors work, and they also work on PARP trapping. So when there's a break in DNA and the PARP enzyme sticks to the DNA. It sticks and then has to fall off. But the PARP inhibitor basically allows that enzyme to stick to the DNA, and that doesn't allow the DNA to repair itself. So a lot has been made about these subtle differences in different PARP inhibitors around PARP trapping, etc. And the bottom line is we don't know if that actually translates into different efficacies amongst the PARP inhibitors.
So I've got to ask you, were you in Copenhagen for ESMO?
I was in Copenhagen for ESMO.
So, you know, I'm going to tell you, you probably didn't think about this, but when I heard about what happened there, I was thinking about the 2005 ASCO meeting, which was the adjuvant trastuzumab trials. You couldn't get in there. It was like a madhouse, you know.
Right.
But actually, in that same meeting in breast cancer, Rowan Schablowski on the other end of the ASCO was presenting the WINS study of dietary fat in breast cancer, which I thought was really cool, but nobody even knew about it because they were all looking at the adjuvant trastuzumab. And when I started talking to people who were in Copenhagen, I was hearing about the big first-line checkpoint inhibitor lung trials.
Right.
And they said that, you know, it was like Justin Bieber was there. You couldn't get in. It was like this madhouse.
Yep.
And then I start reading about this trial in ovarian cancer that was presented.
Yep.
And I'm like, whoa, that is major. Really, I don't know, you tell me. To me, this was like a step forward, which of course was this really incredible niraparib maintenance phase 3 study that was presented.
Mm-hmm.
So I know you were one of the authors on this. If you could just kind of go through this A to Z, because to me, ovarian cancer changed at least when I saw these data.
Yeah, no, I agree. And the paper was not only presented at ESMO, but it's online in the New England Journal of Medicine right now. And in fact, I presented some of the data this weekend in Portugal, in Lisbon, at the IGCS, International Gynecologic Cancer Society meeting. So yeah, no, the data is definitely out there. It's an exciting study because it really does expand the use of a PARP inhibitor to other populations of patients besides those who have underlying BRCA mutations. But I think also this is not a surprise because this kind of a trial really, as I said before, distills a patient and a cancer that is previously sensitive to platinum, continues to be in response to platinum, and is a high-grade type of cancer. So we really have taken the essence of all the characteristics where a PARP inhibitor should work. So the fact that you see this improvement in progression-free survival of niraparib versus placebo in all of the 3 predefined patient populations makes sense.
Well, it might make sense, but there's one number in particular that I really want to ask you about. But before we get to that number, maybe you can just talk a little bit about the setting and the design of the study.
So again, it was a study that was modeled after study 19, but a phase 3, again, an attempt as a registration trial. So taking
study 19 being the olaparib maintenance study.
That's correct, because we had already known about that study that had been presented, and it was positive. So this was taking patients up front who were platinum sensitive, previously in receipt of platinum, had at least 4 cycles of platinum-based chemotherapy, had either a CR or a PR via investigator assessment to platinum, and then were then BRCA tested up front, and then they were put into 2 groups, either those patients who had a germline BRCA mutation versus not, so 2 separate populations, and then randomized to either niraparib versus placebo in those 2 main populations.
And the duration was indefinite?
The duration was indefinite, that's correct. The patients were followed via CAT scan. That's how we made the assessment of disease progression.
And just to clarify, in terms of the prior olaparib maintenance study, which you actually ran, that was just BRCA, correct?
So no, that was also high-grade serous cancer.
And I think it was a randomized phase 2?
It was a randomized phase 2, 1-to-1, that's correct.
And you saw a dramatic benefit, correct?
Correct. So in the study 19, there was a benefit between olaparib versus placebo, and that difference in progression-free survival was a little under 4 months or so. But then there was a retrospective analysis looking at the patients who had either germline BRCA or had a somatic BRCA mutation, but it was a pre-planned retrospective analysis. And that's where you saw that 7-month improvement in progression-free survival between olaparib versus placebo. So further distilling those patients.
Right, but I guess that wasn't enough to get it approved in that setting in the United States.
Right. Yeah, that was the ODAC meeting that I presented at, and that was just terrible. That was an awful ODAC meeting. Yeah, no, there was, even though that was just a few years ago, I think that because it was the first trial and that PARP inhibitors were newish at that point, now PARP inhibitors are used, you know, more studies being run. It's shown efficacy in other cancers besides ovarian cancer. The mechanism of action is understood, et cetera. So I think we're in a different time in 2016, 2017, compared to 2014.
But if I remember correctly, if I'm thinking of the right cancer, it is approved in Europe?
So olaparib is approved in Europe based upon study 19 results. That's correct.
For maintenance.
For maintenance. That's correct.
But not in the U.S., it's just like fourth line advanced disease.
Yeah, you have to have received 3 lines or more of prior chemotherapy. Solo 2 is a recapitulation of study 19, except that patients had to have a germline BRCA mutation or somatic BRCA, and they just had a press release this morning.
Which said what?
Which basically showed that the patients receiving olaparib versus placebo had an improved progression-free survival that was better than was seen in study 19. But that is a different trial than the NOVA study, the niraparib, where you've broadened that patient population to now not just include germline or somatic BRCA, but high-grade serous or high-grade endometrioid cancer.
And we're going to get back to that in a second. But just, you know, you were referring to the months of extension, but what I recall was more the hazard rate, which was pretty impressive. I think it was, do you remember the number?
I mean, 0.35, 0.38, yeah. It was impressive.
Yeah, so it's more than 60% reduction in progression. So I guess the issue with not having olaparib approved was that more related to the fact that it was a phase 2 and not a phase 3, not enough data type thing, or what was the reason?
So I think 2 things came out of that ODAC meeting. One was toxicities, and the second was this long conversation about primary endpoint and could you have progression-free survival without demonstrating improvement in quality of life? So there was that problem that the study 19 did not show an OS. Well, it wasn't powered for overall survival. It was powered for progression-free survival. And again, maintenance therapy, these are patients who are on the heels of platinum-based chemotherapy. They're in remission. So they're actually feeling pretty well. So from a tumor burden standpoint, they shouldn't have many tumor-related symptoms. They may be feeling tired from the chemotherapy. So it would be very difficult to show an improvement in quality of life for a PARP inhibitor versus placebo in the maintenance setting. If you had somebody who was a tumor-bearing patient, basically who had cancer that was active and symptomatic, then one would expect to see an improvement in quality of life, or you should try to see that if you're looking at progression-free survival as an endpoint. So the one issue was around you didn't get an OS. You just got PFS, and you didn't show improvement in quality of life. But again, there's an argument against that, because how would you expect to see an improvement in quality of life if you're dealing with a patient who's feeling pretty well? And then secondly was the acute leukemia risk, MDS risk, that was pulled out by the chair of the committee at that point. And yes, these are patients who are, some of them have underlying BRCA mutations, germline BRCA mutations, so they are at higher risk of developing secondary leukemias. They've all had platinum at least now twice. So they've had exposure to alkylating agents. And I think 2 pieces of information really put the AML MDS risk into perspective. One is from study 19, is that at ASCO this year, since the study 19 paper was originally published, there have been no further cases of AML or MDS, which is, I think, very reassuring. And in the NOVA trial, the risk of MDS or AML was proportional for the randomization. So there were an equal number of cases within patients receiving niraparib versus placebo. So it wasn't predominantly in the niraparib. There actually were some patients in the placebo arm who developed an AML or MDS. It happens. It's a rare event, but it does occur in patients with ovarian cancer.
Well, in any event, so that background in terms of olaparib as maintenance therapy really just preceded this paper presented at Copenhagen that you just described. Now, you said that they took the patients who were BRCA germline negative and tested them for, you said, BRCA somatic mutations, but the paper says homologous recombinant positive. How did they define that? Is that the same thing as BRCA somatic?
So up front, there was a randomization between underlying germline BRCA versus non-germline. And then the patients who were gBRCA negative were then retrospectively tested through an HRD assay, a homologous recombination deficiency assay. And that looks at different components of how one could define a cancer that was HR deficient.
But it's not just BRCA genes, right?
No, it's basically looking at scarring that occurs to the DNA that is representative of a cancer that has underlying homologous recombination deficiency.
Okay, so let me tell you my number that I'm so fascinated by. So you mentioned the fact that in all three of these groups, there was an advantage. But again, I'm always thinking hazard ratio. So for germline, I like that gBRCA. I haven't heard anybody say that. I like that abbreviation. So with the gBRCA patients, the hazard ratio for progression was 0.27.
Mm-hmm.
Then the non-germline BRCA with the HRD positivity, hazard ratio 0.38. Again, kind of same ballpark, similar looking curve, maybe not quite as impressive. But the thing that really blew my mind was the germline negative and HRD negative mm-hmm. patients,
mm-hmm.
and the hazard ratio is 0.45.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's the one that kind of surprised me.
Yeah, again, I think that it really just says to you that PARP inhibitors have activity in platinum-sensitive, recurrent, high-grade cancers. Because of the, you're really distilling out, pulling out patients who have this homologous recombination deficiency phenotype because they're responding to platinum, but also genotype as well.
And these are, I mean, several hundred patients. So mm-hmm. one of the things I thought about here is, you know, we just went into this whole thing of why BRCA testing now is standard for every patient with ovarian cancer therapeutically. But maybe if this model plays out, maybe you'd want to see it just to predict how they're going to do. But it really, maybe it's we're going to be in a situation where everybody's going to get it anyhow.
So I think that you pointed out before that the importance of knowing a germline mutation for the family, for the cascade testing to really help other members who are unaffected so they can prevent their further potential risk of developing ovarian cancer. I mean, I think another issue comes up is, and I don't know how this is going to go, but as we're thinking about germline testing versus somatic testing, and if we take a cancer and that cancer at the initial, I mean, there are a few issues here. One is that the patient's diagnosed and we submit that cancer to some sort of next-gen sequencing and you find underlying deleterious BRCA mutation, and then that patient would then go on to germline testing to see whether or not she's got a germline mutation or this is purely somatic. And it depends upon how the tumor genomics field goes. I mean, right now we're not doing that. We're starting with germline testing. And then the other whole piece, of course, is around the HRD assays and how predictive or not predictive they are and where they sort of fit in. And I think, you know, obviously the regulatory agencies are going to take a look at this data both here and in Europe and make that determination. But the one issue with HRD assays is that you're taking that result and you're taking it and you're getting that result from an initial tumor. So from a cancer at initial diagnosis, where we know that 80% plus patients, their cancer at that point is going to be sensitive to chemotherapy, sensitive to platinum-based chemotherapy. And then as patients go into remission and then recur again, that cancer sensitivity to platinum changes and it becomes increasingly platinum, and it can also become increasingly PARP inhibitor resistant. So those HRD assays really look at a moment in time. And a moment in time, when the cancer is in pretty good shape in terms of being able to respond to a platinum-based chemotherapy. So I think that there's a whole field now that's emerging with DNA repair experts at the forefront of this in terms of at that moment in time for a patient, what's her cancer doing? Is it going to be responsive to a PARP inhibitor? Do we have to use a PARP inhibitor combination? What happens if the patient's on a PARP inhibitor and progresses? I mean, these are all open questions right now.
You mentioned the fact that, and it was very interesting about this idea that maybe HRD status would change. Mm-hmm. Have serial HRD measurements been done where you compare the results up front to, you know, later line platinum resistant, for example?
Yeah, not in a very good way, no. And I think that's going to have to be done because you really do need patients who agree to having, you know, at least at this point, a tumor biopsy done at sequential time points.
Can you do it on ascites?
Well, not many patients will have ascites. You know, I think with how we treat ovarian cancer, somebody who has active ascites, to me, is pretty ill. And I think the paradigm of treating early really prevents that accumulation of ascites, because I think a lot of physicians around the U.S. have a very good understanding of how to treat ovarian cancer, so that you really prevent that development of symptomatic ascites until a patient is closer to death.
So actually, in a couple days, I'm going to be working with your colleague Jeff Oxnard in lung cancer, and we're going to spend like a whole day talking about targeted therapy and, you know, assays and trying to figure that out.
Right.
One of the things that actually Jeff's had a leadership role in have been serum assays for mutations. And what about that for ovarian cancer and HRD measurements?
So a number of people are looking at circulating DNA. So that may be something to look at, but it's very early. You really have to, it's complicated to look at HRD. I mean, you need, ideally would need a cell to look at the different proteins present. But if you're looking specifically at BRCA mutations, we're not there yet. We're not there yet.
Knowing that we were going to chat today, I kind of put out my feelers to people out there in the community and said, hey, give me some questions and cases.
Yeah.
And here's my favorite one. A 45-year-old lady, BRCA2 germline mutations, diagnosed with stage 3A serous ovarian cancer, undergoes optimal debulking surgery, 6 cycles of adjuvant carboplatin. She's now free of disease, has a normal CA125, but apparently is a very educated patient, mm-hmm. and found out about the niraparib maintenance study.
Uh-huh.
And wants to know if the doc will prescribe maintenance olaparib.
Yeah.
What would you say?
Well, based upon the confines of the US FDA.
Well, let's say maybe the patient will pay for it.
Yeah.
Let's make it easy.
So that trial is called SOLO-1. And SOLO-1 are for exactly that patient population. Newly diagnosed, has an underlying germline BRCA mutation or somatic BRCA mutation. At the completion of chemotherapy, they're randomized to either olaparib versus nothing, and no results. So we just heard about SOLO-2, but that's in maintenance. SOLO-1 is the patient who is at risk, but you don't know. And I think there, and I've been asked by patients that before, my answer is no, I would not do it because A, we don't have data. Secondly, this patient may be cured. I mean, there is a subset of women, as we know, she's already said, you know, she's stage 3A, so she's already got a better prognosis than somebody with stage 3C. She was optimally cytoreduced. So these are all good prognostic features. She's young. So there's going to be a percentage that she may be cured, 20-25%, possibly, yes. So why give her a medication that we know has side effects? First, we don't have data. Second, she may be cured. And then third, there are going to be potential side effects of an PARP inhibitor. I think it's also the do no harm, because you have a patient who may actually do quite well. And I think the other piece is that you don't know what olaparib is going to do in this situation. Is it going to prolong progression-free survival? Is it going to have an impact on overall survival? Is it going to make her cancer more curable? And with what downsides? The downsides being these risks of potential AML-MDS, although I think very low for her since she's only had one round of chemotherapy. But she's going to take a pill. She's going to take not just a pill, she's going to take 16 capsules per day.
So I'll ask you to put your crystal ball hat on and predict 10 years from now what you think the impact of PARP inhibitors would be up front in this situation. And patients never just gotten chemo for the first time. Platinum sensitive, platinum resistant. When it's all played out and we've studied all those arenas, How do you think the impact of PARP inhibitors are going to compare in those three scenarios?
Yeah, well, I think certainly for patients who have germline BRCA, hopefully by 10 years from now, we'll have identified which patients within that G-BRCA group are going to have the best responsiveness, because even within a G-BRCA group or a somatic BRCA group, not all patients are going to respond to PARP inhibitors. So really teasing out which patients are going to have the highest response. So for sure, PARP inhibitors will be there. I think PARP inhibitor combinations are going to be critical. And right now, combining them with the other active biologic agents in ovarian cancer. So number one would be antiangiogenics. So there are Trezepayola trial that is looking at the combination of olaparib plus bevacizumab in patients who are newly diagnosed. And so what do you do adding a PARP inhibitor to bevacizumab? We've already talked about PARP inhibitors plus cedarinib, but then also immuno-oncology agents and PD-1, PD-L1, which we know as single agents have very limited activity in ovarian cancer. So they also are going to need some kind of a boost, and whether or not that's combining with a PARP inhibitor, combining with other agents. So I see the landscape further moving along the breast cancer landscape, where you carve out the patient populations into smaller subgroups, those requiring a PARP inhibitor, those requiring a PARP inhibitor combination, or not, and focusing on something else. I think SOLO-1 is going to tell us how important a PARP inhibitor is going to be for those women who have an underlying germline mutation. Other PARP inhibitors, specifically niraparib, are being tested up front. Veliparib, which we haven't talked about, is being tested in an upfront NRG trial. So you're going to have a number of studies reporting out in both G-BRCA patients along with non-G-BRCA or wild-type patients, and kind of seeing what the results look like. What's the risk-benefit ratio looking like?
It's interesting you brought up immunotherapy. I thought I saw that you're running a trial of a checkpoint inhibitor with a PARP inhibitor.
So yeah, our group is running part of our Stand Up to Cancer ovarian cancer team. Panos Konstantinopoulos is the PI of that study, and that's a combination of pembrolizumab, PD-1 inhibitor, plus niraparib.
And are you using PD-1 levels? We were talking about the big lung thing in Copenhagen. Are these patients only your PD-1 positive or everybody?
It's everybody. But it's specifically patients who are platinum resistant, but who have displayed prior sensitivity to platinum. So initially platinum sensitive, but then platinum resistant.
You mentioned that the single agent checkpoint inhibitors haven't looked all that great, but what are the PD-1 levels that you see in ovarian cancer?
So they are, you know, it really depends upon the assay. I think ovarian cancer can be PD-L1 positive, but they don't seem to necessarily be predictive of response, at least at this point. So in the smaller phase 2 trials of pembro, nivolumab, and avelumab, so pembro was specifically in patients who had cancers PD-L1 positive, but the others were mixed. That's where you see these between 10 to 15% response rates, all in heavily pretreated patients. We're just finishing up the KEYNOTE 100 trial that looks at single agent pembrolizumab, not based upon PD-L1, but PD-L1 is being looked at retrospectively to try to tease out what effect PD-L1 levels have. And also, does platinum resistance make a difference? Platinum sensitive make a difference? How many prior lines? But I think that ovarian cancer is very potentially an immunogenic cancer, but it may need something in addition to a PD-1 or a PD-L1 inhibitor.
It's interesting that you talk about trials looking at combining things with PARP inhibitors. And then in the checkpoint world, you keep hearing about all these things they're combining with checkpoint inhibitors, chemotherapy,
yep,
targeted therapy. And now your trial, it's coming together for both of them. So we'll see what happens. Why don't we talk a little bit about, it looks like you would think that medical oncologists are going to now have two PARP inhibitors to use. I mean, you would think, you know, people certainly look at this data would want to use it. We'll see what happens with the FDA. So we're going to start getting into a thing that we've already seen in other cancers, aromatase inhibitors, for example, in breast cancer, which is multiple drugs approved within the same class. So I want to tease out from you a little bit about, you know, how you can separate them. And to get into that, I want to give you a couple more cases. I don't get too far away from the day-to-day practice that were sent in to me. So here's a good one. Kind of reminds me a little bit of your patient. 62-year-old woman, germline BRCA mutation with recurrent disease, and started as third-line therapy with olaparib. Third line, that's interesting. Anyhow, I'm not sure how that happened, but starts on 400 POBID. 4 weeks into the therapy, the patient's hemoglobin drops from 10.5 to 8.5. No evidence of bleeding or hemolysis. What do you do? And specifically, the question about ESAs in this situation.
Yeah, good point. So I think the drop to 8.5 is not unexpected. You would expect to have some blood count drops. And I think every PARP inhibitor causes myelosuppression, and it can cause a drop in neutrophil count. It can drop count in red and platelets as well. And especially someone who's received prior chemotherapy. So regardless of PARP inhibitor, you have to watch blood counts. And I think in somebody who I'm concerned about when I'm starting them on a PARP inhibitor, certainly olaparib, and it's definitely true in the niraparib studies, is that you follow counts weekly, yeah, just for the first month, just to make sure that they're okay. So for this particular lady, she drops from 10 to 8.5. So she's already low when she started. She's a little bit lower. I think if she's feeling okay and she doesn't have underlying known cardiac disease and she's not affected quality of life, I would keep it going. But I would certainly counsel her that, yes, your hemoglobin is dropped. I want you to be particularly cognizant of how you're feeling. And if you're not feeling well in the next 4 weeks before I see you again, I want you to let me know and I'll bring you in early for another CBC check.
How about ESAs?
I know I'm really biased. I don't use them at all. I know people do. So I guess you could, but I guess theoretically, and just because of the potential for an ESA to cause cancer progression, is that black box warning on all those labels, I don't use them at all. I would dose reduce and then occasional transfusion.
So one other case in the community, and then I want to kind of get into this comparison. I thought this was a really interesting thought. 54-year-old woman with a germline BRCA2 mutation is on olaparib and doing well, responding. Mm-hmm. 10 months into therapy, the patient starts to show slow, asymptomatic growth of peritoneal metastatic nodules. Doesn't say anything about the CA-125, but let's assume it's going up. The question is, would you keep the olaparib going and add something else like chemo or Bev, like the trastuzumab thing or the androgen suppression in prostate cancer? I'm guessing it hasn't been studied.
Right.
Does it make sense?
Yeah, and this happens a lot because I do think, and again, I don't have any great data of this, but certainly from my own practice, I think PARP inhibitors will suppress the growth of tumors. So you can have this low-level progression, but the patient feels great. Maybe her CA-125 is starting to go up, and she's showing some evidence of growth, but to me, it wouldn't be clinically significant. So I think the doc has to make that determination. Is this clinically significant or not? And is this a reason to change treatment strategies? Because probably the patient is saying, doc, I don't want to come off this drug because I'm actually doing okay on it. I feel all right. So I would say if there is non-significant clinical growth, like there are just some millimeter changes in peritoneal implants and her CA-125 is just maybe headed up slightly, I might say, let's recheck you in 2 months and let's see how you're doing. But if the doc says, okay, this is clinically significant, I'm concerned, then you're right. Then we don't have a clear strategy moving forward. And there are strategies afoot. My colleague Amit Oza has a trial that is adding cediranib to olaparib at olaparib progression. We're working on a trial with our colleagues at MD Anderson that's adding a WEE1 inhibitor to a PARP inhibitor at the time of PARP inhibitor progression. So there are now strategies that are being determined that would allow a patient to stay on a PARP inhibitor, but you add something to that. And whether it's another agent that is, you know, involved in DNA repair or totally another one like a antiangiogenic or maybe even immunotherapy, but we don't know.
So how about outside a trial setting? This doc, for example, says, how about if I just add some Bev?
Have I seen that happen? Yes, I have. Do I have any evidence? Does anyone have evidence that that's of benefit? No, you don't know. I don't know. I mean, I guess you could, but there's absolutely no data to suggest that that would be a good thing. I think what I would not do is add chemotherapy because of the overlapping bone marrow toxicities of PARP inhibitors and chemotherapy. There's really no justification for adding chemotherapy to a PARP inhibitor. That patient will for sure get into problems with myelosuppression.
So that's a really good point. Let's talk about the different PARP inhibitors, and particularly in terms of the tolerability and whatever you can tease out in terms of efficacy. And you mentioned veliparib, but also at that same meeting, at the ESMO meeting, there was a big presentation on a drug called rucaparib, which we've heard a little bit about. It was from, I guess, some data from a couple studies. What was presented there? What do we know about rucaparib, veliparib, efficacy-wise, first of all?
Yeah, so they all have single-agent activity. And so...
in BRCA germline only or non-BRCA too?
Well, so the NRG GOG did a trial looking at single-agent veliparib in germline BRCA cancer, showing a response rate. Response rate was perhaps a little bit lower than a drug like olaparib, but certainly has response. So I think is a real PARP inhibitor. Rucaparib's data has been presented in a number of different settings, a number of different meetings, and there's not a final publication, but that has received breakthrough status from the FDA. Rucaparib has for, looks like for germline and somatic BRCA, but not for non-BRCA cancers.
So the other person on this program, Tom Herzog, told me that he thought there were going to be three approved PARP inhibitors in the near future.
Yep.
Including rucaparib, niraparib, as well as olaparib. Do you agree?
I would agree with that, yes.
Any others that you think might be close to approval?
Well, veliparib, no, because its strategy has been to add to chemotherapy in a newly diagnosed patient, and that's we don't have any results on that. The other, talazoparib, you know, has been passed on to a number of different companies, and so they are a little bit late to the ovarian cancer clinical trial queue. So I don't see that being an approved drug in ovary now.
So trying to sort of, from a macro point of view, compare what we know about tolerability issues, you mentioned the issue of myelosuppression, and I thought it was really interesting. It looked like in the niraparib study, it was more platelets.
Correct. So I think as a class effect, PARP inhibitors have two main toxicities. One is gastrointestinal, and then secondly, bone marrow suppression. So I think you have to expect both when you start any of these PARP inhibitors in patients. But you're correct. So you have to watch out for thrombocytopenia, watch out for neutropenia, and watch out for anemia.
And again, looking at least these three that seem to be with the two almost near approval, any gut, you know, interestingly, gut feeling about the relative GI toxicity? Do you think it's the same? Do you think some are worse?
I think the GI toxicity is pretty much the same. And I've been impressed how some patients are just more sensitive to the GI toxicity. I guess what we don't have yet, and that decision-making is not there yet, if you've got three or even two PARP inhibitors in play, and you start off with one, and you say, wow, you know, you're having a lot of nausea from this drug. Let's see if we switch you to another one, what will happen? Much like aromatase inhibitors in breast cancer, if somebody was having significant, you know, joint pain or headaches or whatever, if you switch them to the aromatase inhibitor, did that make a difference? Well, I think the problem is that these are class effects, and there's absolutely no data on moving from one PARP inhibitor to another.
Yeah, I think, you know, the aromatase story is almost like lore more than science.
Exactly,
you know,
that's right.
Docs say, we just try it. We don't know why sometimes,
yep.
You know. But what about efficacy? Do we know right now, for example, if somebody has disease progression on one PARP inhibitor, whether or not they might respond to another?
So I think that that's more of a case of the cancer continuing to be sensitive to a, potentially sensitive to a PARP inhibitor, much like reuse of platinum. And certainly in my practice, if I've had a patient who's been on, and I can only really say this with olaparib because we have this capability of reusing olaparib again, but if a patient had done very well in a clinical trial, came off because of progression and in sort of a setting for that, one of the cases that you presented where she's got progression, but it's not really clinically significant, but she has to come off the trial, I've in future circumstances reused olaparib. And in some circumstances, showing responsiveness. But again, that's not surprising because of the platinum story where you can use platinum, patient progresses, then you come back with another platinum at another time point, again, showing this in continued sensitivity to the drug. But what I can say is that if you switched PARP inhibitors, would you get better efficacy? I mean, they're PARP inhibitors, so I think they work in similar ways. So to me, they should all work.
Although there was a PARP inhibitor that wasn't a PARP inhibitor in breast cancer, I think it was called, was that inipirib that Joyce has shown?
But that's not a PARP inhibitor. Yeah, that's not a PARP inhibitor.
They thought it was a PARP inhibitor. Turned out that it wasn't, but
that drug was a problem because it set the PARP inhibitor field back years.
Absolutely.
And it was not good.
Yeah.
Not good.
Poor Joyce
yeah.
O'Shaughnessy. I remember that day.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, you mentioned when you said the Keynote 100 trial, I was like, yeah, there probably are 100. I don't, you know, it's like there's so many checkpoint trials. And it really leads me to the question of, and I know we don't have the data to answer it. I mean, when I ask right now the melanoma people or lung people, do you think there's a difference between pembrolizumab, nivolumab, and atezolizumab for that matter? And they go, if there is, we can't see it yet. Now, obviously, we don't have that kind of data with PARP inhibitors at all.
Right.
But I'm kind of getting the feeling from you that you think eventually it's going to work out that there isn't going to be much difference. Is that your thinking?
That's my thinking. Yeah, I think from an efficacy standpoint. And then clinicians are going to have to make decisions based upon where the data is. I think that's just going to have to be just like we do with drugs like bevacizumab. But ovarian cancer is also unique in that there was this 8-year hiatus between 2006 and 2014 between Carbogem, which was the last FDA approval, and then 2014, where you get both Bev and Olaparib approved. So I think as oncologists treating women with ovarian cancer, we haven't had the ability to use new therapies in our treatment. And now we're going to start doing that because, yeah, I think it's a hugely exciting time in ovarian cancer therapeutics.
Looks like you had a poster at ECHO last year. Management of nausea and vomiting during treatment with the capsule and tablet formulations of the PARP inhibitor olaparib.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn from that?
So we mostly learned that the side effects are present, not surprising. And I think also that what can end up happening is that there's a buildup of tolerance to these side effects. So if a patient starts to develop some nausea or vomiting, or anorexia, or dyspepsia, if she can tolerate the medications, more often than not, those side effects will get better. Exactly why that occurs, not sure, but that those side effects tend to get better. In a less ideal world, you'd give that patient a break, but I think that, and I think this is another important point that I want to make, for PARP inhibitors, these drugs are meant to give continuously. So I think I would really, unless the patient is having a lot of distress, I think taking away the PARP inhibitor, giving her a break, may not be the best thing to do, but to continue that continuous therapy. Obviously, if she's miserable, you got to give her a break. So that's what we learned from that, is that, yes, there are toxicities. They tend to get better with time.
I'm not sure what it means, but I see that you also looked at the time that the patient got the drug, morning, afternoon, evening, anything from that that came out?
Not really.
Not really.
No.
Not a food-related type thing?
No, no. And we now know that patients can eat with the PARP inhibitor. That's okay. Yeah.
Anything else in terms of PARP inhibitors or BRCA testing that we haven't talked about today that you want to bring up?
We didn't talk about this, but there are going to be differences with the number of pills or capsules taken per day for niraparib versus rucaparib versus olaparib. Although I think if SOLO2, we just heard about the results of SOLO2 briefly in the press release, but that is using the tablet form of olaparib versus the capsule form. So the tablets are 100 milligrams. So you take fewer tablets per day. It's 300 twice daily as opposed to 400 twice daily. Rucaparib, that comes in, I believe, 300 milligram tablets. And then niraparib comes in 100 milligram tablets. So the tablets and the how many pills patients take per day will be slightly different amongst those three.
What's the bottom line in terms of the number of pills you take a day with the three drugs?
So for right now, for olaparib using the capsule, it's 16 capsules per day because they come in 50 milligram capsules. However, the subsequent trials, so SOLO 1, 2, and 3, are using the tablet formation. So that should be three tablets twice daily.
And is that available commercially?
I mean, no, it's not. It's not available commercially.
You're saying if it gets approved, then maybe they'll start making these?
You got it. That's correct.
And so right now it's 16 pills a day, could go down to 6. Okay.
Right.
And then what about the other two?
So niraparib is 100 milligram tablets, and that's going to be so 3 per day. That's 300 milligrams dosed once daily. And then rucaparib is 600 milligrams twice daily. And I believe rucaparib is in 300 milligram tablets, so that would be 2 tablets twice daily.